Okay, I would like to complete a little bit my last discussion yesterday before I move to another topic. So I spoke about the integration of astronomy and astrology, and as I mentioned, it was not just an intellectual exercise, but the assumption that is one of the meanings, or what may be the most important meaning, of the commandments. The commandments are related to the astral bodies and indirectly to the Sefirot. And what is the meaning in this case? In the case of the Theosophy, the idea was to have an impact on the Sefirot. In astronomy, you cannot have an impact on the planets. But what you can do is to draw from the planets power down. That is called astromagic. And that is widespread theory of magic in the Middle Ages, being found in thousands of discussions in the Middle Ages, including in Arabic, Christian, and Jewish stuff. So, in this framework, the commandments are intended to bring down power. Meaning, commandments were done in a way which are sympathetic, corresponding to the astral bodies. And the idea is to bring down on the person who performs the commandments specific powers from different planets. That's why the rituals were understood is taking place in specific forms, times, objects, places. In such a way, as I mentioned, the temple, the tabernacle, everything was considered to be attuned to an astral body. Which means, and that's the point I would like to make, it's another form of empowerment of the performer. So, if earlier the empowerment was by having an impact on the Sefirot, now the impact is on what's going on here below. But the common denominator is empowerment. The assumption that someone is capable to do something very significant in the objective world. The objective world can be the divine, it can be the corporeal world. But the assumption is that the performance is not a matter of blind obedience. It has a very specific significance, and that is the answer to the question, why? So you can see how different forms of Kabbalah, in quite different forms, are still addressing the same major question. Okay, so that was how to put it in. To round out the earlier discussion, and now I'm moving to a totally different form of Kabbalah, which is well represented here by a book I wrote, which was in fact the beginning of my career, and that is a Kabbalah which has little to do, if at all, with the other forms of Kabbalah, but has a lot to do with Maimonides. So, if until now the two forms of Kabbalah discussed, the theosophical one, is for sure not Maimonidean, and the magical one, or the talismanic one, was for sure anti-Maimonidean. The third form of Kabbalah that I'm going to present is as Maimonidean as possible. And from this point of view, we can see how central Maimonides was, either in a positive or in a negative way, that doesn't matter. So, there is a branch of Kabbalah which sees in Maimonides one of the most important sources for Kabbalah, no less. For sure it is also influenced, it's not only a matter of an image or rhetorics, but in a very clear way, as I'm going to describe, more than one Kabbalist belonging to the school regard Maimonides as one of the two major sources There are two major sources I'm going to discuss. One of them is Maimonides. So here we have a totally different attitude to Maimonides. So Maimonides gave birth not only to Kabbalah by triggering a reaction to him, but also by really creating, by his thought, a certain important line in Kabbalah. So this Kabbalah is called by, in Hebrew, prophetic Kabbalah. It can be translated correctly, in my opinion, ecstatic Kabbalah, because the major aim is to have an ecstatic experience. So before I enter in known details, I would like to tell you an Italian story about who created this Kabbalah, and then we shall enter more the content. So, in 1240, which is a very important date in the Jewish calendar, 1240 is exactly 5,000 years from the creation of the world according to the Jewish calendar. So someone was born in the beginning of the 6th millennium. So that's, in Christian terms, has no meaning. In Jewish terms, that is, he is born in the right moment, which is the last millennium according to some calculations. So he was born in 1240 in the Basconian part of Spain and Saragossa, left as a child, as an infant, to Tudela, was educated by his father in Tudela. His father, the name is Avraham Abulafia. His father, somewhere unknown, otherwise not a great scholar, no information about him at all. His father died when Abulafia was age of 18. After a year or two, Abulafia makes the first trip to the Orient. And he leaves Spain via the Byzantine Empire. Apparently he married there, left his wife there, and went to Acre in the Galilee. Why? It's quite clear why. He was looking for, the way he put it, a legendary river named Sambation, which in Jewish messianic mythology is the place where the 10 lost tribes are found, and the messianic era will start with the tribes coming back, crossing the Sambation River. So that's well known. So someone going to look for the Sambation, for sure, engage in some form of messianic speculation, aspiration, doesn't matter. Why did he go to Acre to look for such a river? Not totally clear, but I believe clear enough. Everyone knew, including in Spain, that Syria and Jerusalem were invaded then by the Mongols. And the Mongols were conceived to be in Europe by Jews, and here and there also by Christians, as the 10 lost Jewish tribes. And for the Jews, it was a moment of great hope. Meaning, finally, the lost tribes are coming. All the Christian world is collapsing. That was true in 1240. It was Eastern Europe. The Mongols were about to conquer Europe. They were stopped, not because the Christians were able to stop, because they had some problems, the Mongols, in their capital, so they stopped. And the other part was via Syria, Iraq, Syria, Jerusalem. So, reading Christian sources in the 7th century, you see it was simply a world afraid to collapse. For the Jews, it was the opposite. It was a moment of celebration. Abu Lafia and other people in his lifetime in Spain knew about it, and they spoke about the lost tribes as the Jews coming now. So Abu Lafia and the Mongols were not far away from Acre. In 1260, there was a big war not far away from Acre, named a place named Ein Jalut, what is today a kibbutz Ein Harod. And the Mameluk actually destroyed the Mongolian army. But that was exactly when Abu Lafia arrived. He arrived to learn about this war. So it's quite obvious that he was attracted by the Mongols. He was fascinated by the Mongols. And I believe he learned a little bit also Mongolian. We have Mongolian words in Hebrew. So after a while he understood the Mongols are not exactly the tribes. And he returned via he's an empire, he took his wife back and he came to Italy. In Capua, he studied in Capua, the guide of the perplexed. That's good for us, with someone from Verona. A teacher named Hillel of Verona, that's his official name. He studied several years, the way he put it, in a very profound manner. And he became basically a teacher of the guide of the perplexed. Meaning he taught the guide of the perplexed more than any other philosopher in the history of Judaism, up to my colleagues in Jerusalem in the last generation. He was going from city to city, I'm going to tell you, teaching the guide of the perplexed. That was his profession. And he's giving numbers of students in every place he had, so that's 100% true, because we know the names from time to time, and it's not his imagination. So he started as a philosopher. And after 2 or 3 years, around 1265, he's gone back to Spain, to Barcelona. And in Barcelona, he was initiated in Kabbalah, which came after he studied the Kabbalah. What Kabbalah he studied is a little bit less clear. But what seems to be obvious is that he studied forms of Jewish esoterics which were not Spanish, but they were coming from Germany. And the German Jews claimed that they came from Italy, from Apulia, from Bari, and Oria, and Otranto, which story I cannot enter here. So he studied Jewish esoterics, which is not exactly Kabbalah, stemming from centers around Frankfurt of today. Jewish German scholars came to Spain for their reasons, which are important, and they brought with them some books. And Abu Lafia studied those books on every list. That's quite obvious that what he studied. But what Kabbalah he studied is another story. So he studied there for a year, a year and a half, no more, and changed his mind. He was beforehand anti-Kabbalistic, was rationalistic, Maimonides. After a year and a half, he became a Kabbalist and received the revelation, which we're going to discuss much later. After a year and a half, meaning 1271 and a half, something like that, he's leaving Barcelona, going to Castile and teaching the guide of the perplexed in several places in Castile to several people whose names we know and who were important Kabbalists. After a year or two in Castile, maybe 3 at maximum, he returns to the Byzantine Empire. I don't know. His wife was interested with the family, I don't know why. He went to Peloponnese, teaching the guy after he was a Kabbalist. Teaching, no, exactly, in Tebes, he taught in Patros, in several places. And he spent finally 5 years more in the Byzantine Empire. Then, I believe, he came in contact also with some forms of Christian mysticism, what's called Christian Orthodox mysticism, the Athos, the Mount Athos. And I believe he was inspired by some techniques that I'm going to discuss while he was in the Peloponnese. 1279, sometime, 1279, he's coming back to Italy via Trani, and he was arrested there because Jews denounced him, not clear about what, was detained for a month or two, and then left to return to Capua. Then to Capua, he taught again the Bible for faith in the place he studied for student, and then in the summer of 1280, he is coming to Rome with a very clear purpose in mind to speak with the Pope. About what? About what he was told in the Revelation in 1217 in Barcelona. 10 years later, he would like to meet the Pope, but insistent in a certain very clear period, not meeting in general. So we have 1240 was born, 1260 he went to meet 10 tribes, 1270 he had a revelation, 1280 he tries to meet the Pope, which is very, very neat, I must say. 1280. So the Pope was busy. Mm-hmm. And didn't have time for him, and after a while the Pope decided to rest a little bit in a very nice place of his family named Soriano Tacini, not far away from Rome, a very nice place until now. It's a very nice castle. So Abulafia followed the Pope, was told, if you come we're going to burn you. He's claiming that he has seen the autodafé, and he said he doesn't mind. He entered the palace of the Pope, and the Pope died on the spot. Not because Abulafia is telling the story. I checked very well all the records. No exception. All the records are telling the same story. In the Latin, it's always said subito. You don't understand what the meaning of subito. It was so subito that there was no time to bring a confessor to the Pope.
Oh.
Which is really subito. That is subito. So the people were a little confused what to do with this guy. So to burn him and didn't burn him. But they kept him in prison for 2 weeks and then they left him to go. And for 2 weeks he was in prison in Rome, in a small house of the Franciscan Minorite sect, which were also very mystical. And they were related to the Pope, who died then, and he was left whatever he wanted. So he left.
The Pope who
was Nicolaus III. That's the Pope who died. And then came another Pope, which has no relation to this issue, which is Martinus the IV. So Abulafia thought it is more, how to put it, secure to go to Sicily, meaning not far away, but Sicily was then Spanish. So it was, you know, in Messina, meaning just, you know, waiting for the occasion to come back, but not in the jurisdiction of the Pope. So in Messina, 1281, he's creating a school. I mean, gives us a number of students with their names, and some of them can be identified. And he started to teach his Kabbalah, and a little bit also the God of the Blessed, in Messina for almost 30 years. he made some trips to Palermo, and apparently a trip he didn't want to make, but he was expelled in a way to Malta. But in Malta, a small place, island not far away from Malta, Combino, but he turns then to, meaning he had other problems which you don't know exactly why people expect him to such a, you know, impossible place. But he returned to Messina, and he was active there up to 1291, and then we lost any records. We don't know if he died, didn't die, what, how he died, where is he born. Everything is actually totally obscure. So that is the personal story of the founder of this Kabbalah. And I would like to enter now in what is beyond this peregrination and very bizarre activity called the Pope, and he had a lot of controversies with Jews also, meaning he had controversies with everyone who was important in his lifetime. He had a controversy, sharp controversy. So it's quite obvious that there is a messianic element from 1260 up to 1290. He is predicting the Messiah will come in 1290. Who is this Messiah? We can guess. But he considered himself to be the Messiah. That's why he wanted to speak with the Pope. What was the idea to speak with the Pope? So that's not so clear, because we have one very obscure statement. So this obscure statement could be interpreted in more than one way. Some scholars said, look, Abu Lahab was there to convert the Pope. I believe it is not a good interpretation of the Hebrew text. Not only not plausible, but just not philological. Other scholars said, he was the Messiah. He went to the Pope as Moses went to the Pharaoh to ask, let my people go. Which is very nice and romantic, but I believe it doesn't work with the text. It doesn't work with the whole theory of Abulah. My assumption is he wanted to speak with the Pope, not to convert him. Maybe he would like to convert him, but it was not a major idea. But to speak about his form of religion, which is something which is higher than any other positive historical religions, including Judaism. For sure, including Christianity. He wanted to have a conversation with on a spiritual level. And he had good reasons to assume that Nicholas III will be more open, because Nicholas III made some opening toward the Franciscans, who were a little bit dubious for the Pope. Given the fact that Nicholas III was close to the Minorites, which is the more extreme part of the Franciscans, he could imagine that to speak about a very spiritual religion, that's an issue which can be done with the Pope. So that's my assumption. That doesn't mean there's no messianic overtone here. But not messianic in the sense that, you know, Jews were going to leave Italy and return to the land of Israel. It was messianic from the point of view that another form of redemption, which is different from normal messianism, can unify the religions. That is my reading of what did he want to speak with the Pope. Not to convert it. Maybe to convert it to his religion, but not to Judaism. To his religion, which is his Kabbalah, which is something considered to be different than any positive religion, including Judaism. So that was the basic message of this Kabbalah. There is a hidden esoteric meaning of Judaism, which is higher than the rabbinic Judaism, and from many points of view, even in tension with rabbinic Judaism. communist point of view, he had problems with the rabbis, you remember, he was denounced. And then he had a big controversy with the most important rabbi in Spain. Yeah. So my assumption is that his main intention was not to convert the Pope, but to speak about this new, which is for him very old, common denominator, which will elevate all the people. So the Pope decided to die. So Abu Lafia didn't desist. He started to teach Kabbalah to Christians openly. And then he's speaking about how he's going from city to city, from market to market. That's unheard of any Kabbalist before or after. If someone is going to speak openly in the market about Kabbalah to non-Jews, when Kabbalah was then esoteric and not taught even to most of the Jews. That was a breakthrough in the concept of what Kabbalah is. And he claims that he had a success among the Christians more than among the Jews. That he's saying more than once, meaning they are more open. So that's why my assumption is that he didn't want to convert the Pope. As I'm going to show you, it's very difficult to fight such a simplistic image. But he wanted something different, maybe cooperation. Or, I don't know what he may, I don't know if he had one single idea in mind all the time. Also, I don't know. He's writing one line. But for the Jews, it was a danger. Someone who likes to do something like that is simply dangerous for the Jews. And he was considered to be suspect all the time. That this guy can create troubles that no one can expect. So even in Sicily, he was able to have a school. But we know that people came and left and came and left. I mean, there were their tensions. Because I assume in the moment they started to understand that he believed that he is the Messiah, which apparently he didn't say in the first sentence, but only after he drove some students, people had a second thought and left. Some of them came back. And we know about this problem of, you know, people coming and going. Apparently he was very charismatic, and people, some of them returned after they left. So he started to write a long series of books, around 50 books, despite all those peregrinations. He wrote some 50 of them. Out of the 50, we have more than 40. And I believe we are going to find also at least part of other books we can have, which is a huge amount of Kabbalistic books, some of them long. Some of them short. We have 42, 43 out of the 50. What is lost, I'm not sure it's so important, because he wrote also grammar. I believe that part was lost, which is, for me, not so. So he started to write a series of books that I would like to analyze them from the gender, from the genre point of view. First and foremost, he wrote three commentaries on the secrets of the guide of the perplexed. That's very, very important. No one in Jewish history wrote more than one commentary. One commentary is a lot. Three commentaries by Kabbalists on the guide of the perplexed is totally unheard. It has to do with the fact that he was coming and teaching, writing the commentary and leaving the commentary there, going to another community, teaching again. Meanwhile, he changed his mind or reached his views, he wrote another commentary, and another commentary. Two of them are in our hands, full form. The third one, a part in Hebrew, a part in Latin. I'm going to speak of it, translated in the Renaissance, and he survived in basically the Latin language, which keeps also some Hebrew original quotations. So that is a sign of his devotion to the guy. Man, you write three commentaries, you teach the guy all your life. It's no more devotion to Maimonides and something like that. Said, no one, I believe, no philosopher did more to disseminate Maimonides than Abulafia. Doesn't matter how messianic and Kabbalistic it was. But what is even more interesting is the fact that at least one of the three commentaries is found in a very great number of manuscripts. When I had to give a lecture about Maimonides once, I had a comparative look. How many manuscripts are of Abulafia's commentaries? How many are for all the other philosophers? To my great astonishment, if we take all the numbers of the manuscripts of all the commentaries written in Abulafia's lifetime, before then no one wrote any commentary, and 50 years after his death, you take all the manuscripts of all the commentaries together, it's less than the numbers of manuscripts of one single commentary of Abulafia, which means the image of Maimonides was shaped to a very great extent by the mystical understanding of the Maimonides. That seems to me to be very clear, because in a way, also the philosophers who wrote after Abulafia commentaries on the guide were influenced by him. That can be shown. So here we have a situation which is perplexing, if you like. He said the disseminator of Maimonides was in fact a Kabbalist who did more to disseminate Maimonides than the philosopher who commented on Maimonides. And speak of the other who didn't comment. I think about the commentators, so they commented, but the manuscripts are 2, 3, 4 manuscripts. Here we have 35. So if you take all of them together, less than one of the three commentaries of Abulafia. Which means a lot. That's for the Jewish world. We'll speak later about the Renaissance. So that is the first genre, which is very, very important. And there we see a two-level interpretation of the guide. One level is simple. You read the text, line after line, with explanations which are, you know, technical. That he calls the first pass. Many beginners use the text. That's not what is important for him, but important for him is the second level. How do you understand the guide, the secrets of the guide, not the text of the guide? How do you understand what Maimonides doesn't tell you? And that's why he's organizing all the commentaries along 36 rubrics. What are the secrets of the guide that Maimonides didn't reveal, but they are found there? And he is revealing by comparing, and not only, the different discussions that is unfound, not found in any commentary before or later ever. Meaning, someone saying, look, I know the secrets of the guide, Maimonides didn't reveal it, I'm going to read it. And that's what's clear. On one side, what he's saying is doubtfully if that's always what Maimonides thought. But there are major insights there which shouldn't be rejected. I mean, there are moments in which you say, that's very interesting, really very interesting. So, we have here the assumption that Maimonides, the real Maimonides, the secret Maimonides, was a Kabbalist. Was a philosopher, okay, that's the external part. But we should teach the beginners philosophy. They will read the text, like the normal text, and they know a little bit about philosophy. However, for the advanced students, he's revealing, in fact, the real Maimonides. And the real Maimonides was an ecstatic Kabbalist, as you can imagine. But for his reasons, Maimonides believed that he shouldn't reveal this secret, which is also the secret of the entire Torah, Rabulafia. Maimonides made the move from the Torah to a beginning of hinting at the secrets. Rabulafia, which he is now going one pass beyond, revealing finally the secrets of the Torah as found in the Guide of the Prophet. For him, this revelation of the secret is a sign of redemption. One of the three commentaries is called the Book of Redemption. The other commentary is called the Secrets of the Torah. The third commentary is called the Life of the Soul. All the three titles are the same. The Secrets of the Torah is redemption. And redemption is the life of the soul. And the life of the soul is the Secrets of the Torah. We can go again and again, that's the same story. Here we have the message of Rabulafia. For him, real Judaism, unlike traditional Judaism, rabbinic Judaism, is mental development. And mental development culminates into ecstasy, which is a way to be one or become one with God. That is redemption. That is the secret of the entire Torah. So that is fairly clear from the three commentaries. He is also playing game of esotericism. I tell you, I don't tell you, but you know, after reading a little bit, you see that it's closing those issues. So that is a radical form of Maimonidism, a real Maimonidism, a radical form of the philosophy of Maimonidism. But it is not Maimonidean, because Rabulafia believes that he is a prophet and he is the Messiah, which I'm not sure that Maimonides dreamed or something like that. That's the radical part. But to claim that the real life is a life of the soul, and that is redemption, that's for sure Maimonidean. That's Aristotelian, but not Maimonidean. So, in a way, Rabulafia incorporated a major issue in philosophy. From this point of view, Rabulafia is very, very close to Pierre Hadot, who claims philosophy is a way of life, it's not just... So Rabulafia said it very strongly about also Aristotle, and, you know, that is not just knowledge. The knowledge, which is a way of life, I'm going to speak about it in a moment, intended to have an experience of Unio Mystica. That is the top of Rabulafia's work. Someone having such an experience, Unio Mystica, he's a prophet, and he's also Messiah. But here we have a very important shift in what is Messiah. Messiah is not someone taking the people of Israel to a certain place and building a temple at all. And speak about that. Messiah is someone who is giving to the others the key for redemption. And redeeming the others, doesn't matter where they are, the recipe of redemption. So that's messianic. But not messianic in the form of having a figure who is a big fighter and all this stuff from Rabulafia, that's mythology, popular mythology. Redemption is the inner experience. So if you like to use terms found in, this introspective reading of philosophy, that's turning to insight. While messianism is turning outside, changing the world, bringing people in a certain place. All this stuff for Rabulafia, not that it exists, but that is popular mythology, needed for simple people. Real redemption has nothing to do with a temple, with a place, with a time, even something like that. It can take place everywhere, anytime, Jewish or not, And he became, in fact, the emissary of this message. So it's a pity the Pope didn't listen to this message, but that's life. We remain with what we have. But in any case, I would like to show you something which I cannot resist by showing it to you. I gave a lecture related to the Vatican, and I didn't dare to say what I said here. I said about manuscripts for the Vatican, and I sent them the lecture, and to my great surprise, they are publishing in the Osservatore Romano, front page, not my title. That is the interesting part, not my title. But another title, done by someone in the Vatican, I don't know who he is. And what they wrote is the title of my very dry presentation, is Quando Abulafia voleva convertire il Papa. That is one page in Osservatore Romano, which is not my title. I must say, the original, I kept, you know, the original, I had a look to see, maybe, I didn't remember. I sent the other title, no, this is the title. So, it's very interesting. This form of cliché, to convert, the messianism, what is that? Abulafia, that's not important, you know, to convert or to convert. That's no difference if you convert to rabbin today, so it's bad enough. You don't, no difference between Christianity and rabbin today. So he had another message. And despite the fact I attempted to convey this message, it didn't work. So the idea was something was tragic. They wanted to say that he wanted to convert the Pope. But not to say what I intended, that it was not his message. So he had this spiritualistic message, which is very similar to what was going on in Italy in this period in any case. So, how to put fringe figures, very spiritual. Joachim Mies, Franciscans, Italy was replete with them. Enough to read Echoes, The Name of the Rose, which is dealing with those figures. Abulafia could have been a very nice hero in the novel. Unfortunately, Eco wrote, I read my books after him finished. So he wrote another novel with Abulafia, but he should have been in the first novel, In the Name of the Rose. So Abulafia was not far away from those spirituals. Meaning, there are big differences. I would like not to enter now on the differences. They are not the same, and I'm not sure he was inspired. But he is an extreme Maimonidean. They are something different. They are very spiritual, like Abulafia, but coming from a totally different point of view. So here we have what? The Kabbalah, in which commandment? That's a question, you know, what did Abulafia think about commandments? We must work for years to understand. He for sure didn't write the commentary on commandments, like all the other Kabbalists. But when he's speaking about commandments, he's always vague. Doesn't say good, doesn't say bad. It's hinting and contradicting and very hard to write reasonable analysis of what did Abulafia think about the commandments. And that is astonishing. This very fact is astonishing. Meaning, you may say, prima facie, here we have a mental religion, which doesn't need action. For sure not the commandments. And I'm not sure if this reading is not quite plausible. However, he had other forms of actions which were very important. First of all, he was very active, he was hyperactive, more than other Kabbalists, going from place to place and to make such an effort and to speak in front of the people and to create a school and write so many books. He's not a passive mystic at all. But in a more precise, how to put it, form, he created techniques to achieve prophecy. Prophecy is not something coming to you, because God is nice and giving you grace. Abu Rafia's God is like Maimonides. He is dealing with the abstract ideas. He doesn't have time to enter in the small details of our life. He is like Aristotle. God is a mind. So from this point of view, Abu Rafia is very Maimonidean. And, you know, whatever we can do is not going to affect God. It doesn't matter. Sins or good things, doesn't matter. However, what matters is specific ways to arrive to prophecy, which means techniques. So from this point of view, also Abu Rafia is very strongly inclined toward performance. I'm going to describe the religious technique. Meaning, he is not a non-performative Kabbalist. He's a performative, but not choosing the path of the commandments, but the path of whatever I'm going to describe now. So from this point of view, he's very Kabbalistic, but not in the way other Kabbalists were. So he created and he wrote several handbooks how to reach prophecy, or the world to come, or the life of the soul, doesn't matter, it's the same. Very detailed handbooks. It's not 5 pages, not 50 pages, books. With many, many, many details. But what is fascinating is there is no one single technique. The techniques are similar, but they are not identical. Which means Abu Rafia didn't have this fetishism that you can see in many forms of mysticism. There's a technique. You go to a certain place, there's yoga, one form of yoga. You can go to another place too, but one master, one technique. Abu Rafia himself wrote at least 4 different books dealing with the same technique, but with major variations. And each time he's telling you, you must do it exactly in such a way. However, then he's writing another book, which is not exactly the same. Far away from being the same. And then he's writing one book more, that shows how developmental he was. Meaning, after a while, he learned more. And so he enriched his technique by more details, and more and more. So we have those books. And those books remained, some of them at least, in many, many manuscripts, which means they had a huge impact on the history of Jewish mysticism. So our Sukkot were quoted, but the numbers of the manuscript is considerable, which means he contributed something that Kabbalists couldn't find elsewhere. His form of transcendent experience is not related to the normal religious life. Maybe not contradicting, maybe not, maybe yes, it's a matter of interpretation, but that is another dimension. And that's why people copied those books, because it's material you cannot find elsewhere. So he forged another type of Quran. And he put it very openly, that's another, that's superior, that's very, very clear. He was not reticent to say it. A fact which created a huge tension between him and other Kabbalists. Because he's Kabbalah, everyone reading one page sees immediately. It's not normal Quran. In addition to it, the claim to be a prophet and a messiah didn't encourage the establishment to be fond of Abu Rafia. And actually he was attacked and criticized very, very sharply, basically banned. Officially banned by other Kabbalists in Spain, because it was the center, and people started to ask from Sicily. No, this guy is coming, claiming, writing books about he's the Messiah. So they wrote letters to Barcelona to ask the chief rabbi. Chief rabbi attempted to stop his activity. It didn't work. So he wrote more and more and more and more. All the letters against Abu Lafia disappeared. The answers of Abu Lafia to this rabbi are in many manuscripts. That is a fascinating social story. Try to imagine the chief rabbi, the most powerful figure in Spanish Jewry, officially, is writing as he himself put it. I wrote many, many epistles to the communities of Sicily to stop it. None of those epistles survived. I will pay a lot of money for one single half page, not a page, to see, you know, what is the image of Abu Lafia in Spain. I don't have anything. Abu Lafia, the French figure, is answering his opponent in Barcelona, many manuscripts, which is a very important lesson, in my opinion, for what is Jewish culture. Not so simply dominated by rabbinic figures, and all the others are not important. Here is an example of which it is. This rabbi writes and writes and writes, and everything disappears. Abu Lafia writes two letters, but have them in many manuscripts. Now, in order to understand, those letters are terrible, what Abu Lafia wrote. He said very openly to the chief rabbi of Barcelona, "You believe in Tzfirot, which is worse than Christianity. The Christians believe only in three. You believe in ten." Those are the answers, you must understand. That is unheard answer. To say something like that to a chief rabbi who is a Kabbalist, to say you are worse than the Christians. That's anathema. And this letter remained in many manuscripts. While with this rabbi had all the possible authority and jurisdiction on Sicily, he was the rabbi of Sicily also. We don't know. We know that he wrote many, many letters, but what's written in those letters, we had no idea. So here we have, in fact, this spiritual, very strong spiritual drive came into a strong conflict with traditional Judaism. That's why I cannot imagine that Abu Lafia wanted to convert the Pope to rabbinic Judaism. He created biotechnics, not only an ideal of spiritual life. He created a very concrete path that you can start with it in a very specific manner. He discussed what to do phase after phase in many details. Not like in other, let's say, the philosophers, if we accept the more experiential reading of philosophy offered by Hadol, Melan, or the others. So, okay, they are telling you in general terms. General terms, you should contemplate, and you don't know how many minutes, and how many hours, and when, and what age, and what's going to be in the night, and the morning. It's not Abu Lafia. Abu Lafia is telling you exactly. You enter a room. The room must be, you know, in such and such a way. Must be in the night. Must be, you know, the light, without light. You respire or don't respire. Meaning, technique as detailed as any technique you can imagine, more than yoga, for sure, more complex than yoga, or any other technique you can show me. Which means that's not a regular philosophical recommendation, you know. Dedicate yourself to meditation, and you'll see, you know, after a year, two, ten, you'll have some opening of your mind. We're speaking about techniques which are supposed to work instantly. If you are right and you did it correctly. If not, you should do it the next night. So something is wrong with you, apparently. But if you start to study Kabbalah. Today, according to Abu Lahab and his students, in 2 months you must be all, you can be all already an accomplished Kabbalist. You don't speak about, you know, like, you know, Christian mysticism. You study for 40 years, you see, yes or no, the cloud will disappear or not, or the cloud of Europe, the cloud of unknown. Here we don't speak about something, you know, long range. Here we're speaking about from the beginning. A young guy will begin today. In 2 months, he's supposed to have full-fledged prophetic experiences. I don't say that's true or not. I'm saying what is written there, and that's a little bit more than written there. Yes. I shall tell you. I mean, that is very strong form of the class. Very detailed, very complex. I didn't try them, so I don't know if they work or not. I don't say they work. Sholem tried it. He claimed it worked. Yeah, that's someone who really knew what Kabbalah is. When he started to study Kabbalah, he started with Abu Lafia in München in 1918 or 19. He used Abu Lafia's manuscripts home in München to it, and he said it worked. I don't know, but what's written in the text, not what is in reality. The assumption is that must work on the spot. And if that doesn't work, that's made a mistake. So you try it again, and that must work. It's not you're a sinner. It's nothing like you're a sinner, you're not a sinner. All this stuff doesn't exist. Meaning, you know, the ethical part, that's for sure here and there, we would say better to be, you know, a nice guy. But that's not a matter of someone must become a great righteous. And then you will see. It doesn't appear in the mind. Think it's a technical story. You do it correctly. It's a physiological story. It must work. So what do you mean to work? You have a revelation, which means the divine mind enters your mind. But not in a mythological way. The divine mind is found all the time, everywhere. Doesn't change at all. Our mind is closed-minded, so we cannot enter, because we are dealing all the time with stupidities. Our mind is full with stupidities. So nothing intelligent can enter there. In the moment you purify or remove all the normal preoccupations, immediately and automatically, the divine mind enters your mind because it's omnipresent. Not that God is coming to you. God doesn't come, doesn't go. He is here all the time. Problem is, if we open our mind or close our mind. So for Abu Lafay, the techniques were a way to open your mind, to purify your mind. And then, automatically, there's going to be a revelation. It's not a matter of divine grace. He would decide, okay, his guy is nice today, I shall offer him some incense. No, that is an automatic event which is created by the purification of the mind, which automatically is invaded by taking possessed basically, by the divine mind, which is pulsating in the universe all the time. So, here we have another version in which Kabbalah has nothing to do almost with commandments. So maximum we could say to be careful, Kabbalah would say, look, during the day, better to perform commandments, they are important for the society. They keep society, you know, in a stable way. If you don't kill each other, you can survive together. That's fine. But from the spiritual point of view, that's helpful, but it's not spiritual life. Abu Lafia, the spiritual life starts when you leave the community. We enter alone, always alone, in a certain chamber of seclusion or isolation, and you start to perform the techniques. So here, someone can say, maybe it's true, Tagore was not antinomian against the law. The law is for people who are not developed. They need instructions how to live. It gives them calm. Offers the possibility for someone who is advanced not to be attacked and not to be harassed by, you know, vulgus. But real religious life starts alone in the night. So from this point of view, I believe that he is a major departure from rabbinic today's. Also a major departure from Maimonides, who never put it in such a way. I don't know what he thought, but this formulation, which is the most cautious formulation about Apulafia, will be the unimaginable in Maimonides. So that's why it's a radical reading of Maimonides, not Maimonides understood correctly. That's a radical reading of Maimonides. But, astonishingly enough, those writings were not destroyed. On the contrary, they were preserved and had many, many manuscripts, many of them Italians, none of them Spanish. I don't speak a little bit about it. And a lot of them Byzantine and Oriental. I mean, we have a nice number of European manuscripts, and we have 200. A very nice number. But he didn't make his way to Spain. Spain was conquered by the other form of Kabbalah, which was basically related to commandments. And it's not a matter that he was bent. He was bent to Spain. And people, you know how to circumvent it. That's not a problem. He was, in a way, not compatible with Spanish, Jewish, Spanish set of mind. Very centralistic. Very rigorous to a certain extent. And his career was basically an Italian career and a Byzantine career. And then had an impact on the Middle East, the land of Israel, Turkey, the copies there, the manuscripts there, we can see the map, who copied and when, how many. So here we have a totally different approach, which is again not, despite my oneness, is not simply related to mental operation. The mental operation is very, very important, it is true. But it's not achieved by passivity, by cruelism. You say, okay, there are many ways to have a mental life or strong revelation. And we had the whole movement of Buddhism, which is much earlier than Buddhism from 7th century. Master Eckhart, for example, said, you control your mind, you don't have to do anything. God is gone, you see. You don't have a revelation one way or another. But no techniques. What is fascinating with Apulafia is the introduction for the first time in a very strong manner of techniques in the West. Those techniques are related to a variety of sources, meaning not one source. As I mentioned, he was influenced for sure by the Ashkenazi techniques of combining letters, part of his technique. I believe he was influenced by the Athos or Hesychasti technique, when he speaks about you must contemplate your heart, not only your heart. And as he has, it's only your heart. Apulafia said the heart and the mind, something which is not exactly, but nevertheless influenced by Orthodox Christian technique. He was influenced by yoga, I have no doubt. No doubt to go. How, it's another story. But the details are unmistakable. No. He speaks about three forms of respiration, describing something like a stopped respiration. That doesn't exist. No, that's only yoga. So has a variety of sources which enrich him all the time. And he added more and more and more conditions to success. At that moment, without trying, but just to imagine, hard to believe that someone can perform so difficult. At the same time, you must combine thousands of combinations of letters by heart, with a certain vocalization changing every combination of letters, according to a certain system of notation like notes, with high pitch, low pitch, pitch, and then you must move the head according to this, the pitch, move the hands, which to do everything at the same time, to coordinate all this stuff, it's simply impossible. As a beginner, you have a list. But after a while, you must be able to do it by heart and to coordinate all those movements at the same time in a very specific rhythm. You don't do it slowly. You know. Don't think. It's very precise. You must do it all the time. You know, that's an intensification, which is very, very strong. And personally, I don't know how someone can do it. But if someone is able to do it, I'm sure something happened to him. I'm sure. What it happens, I don't know. But I'm confident that it's so difficult that it must change something. For good or for better. So that's a very strong technical approach. And from this point of view, Kabbalah is again very, very performative. Not performative. That's even more performative than before. It's so performative that I simply don't know how someone can do it. With the commandment, okay, you do it slower, you know, intention. That's something which can be understood. And can be done, I assume, without any great problem. With Abulafia, it's much more intense. It becomes more and more intense with the time. Every manual is more complex. Now, what is very important to understand is the clue for this technique is combination related to divine names, which means pronunciation of letters of the divine name. So prima facie, you can say that is divine name, no one pronounces divine name, that's forbidden, etc. Divine name, etc. And that's considered to be the strongest part of the technique because that is considered to be a word of power. However, Abulafia was careful enough not to make the mistake, to put it very, very bluntly. So he said, we'll combine the letter of divine name together with other letters of the alphabet. So you pronounce the letters, but not exactly the tetragrammaton, because you combine each letter with all the other letters of the alphabet. So you create some form of synthesis, which can be excused from the legalistic point of view, despite the fact that the name is found there in a central. But he believed there is some form of strong linguistic element which is capable to change by its pronunciation, to change the state of consciousness. That is the quintessential part, which is then put in relation also to breathing, movements, to moving on the head, melodies, isolation, the middle of the night, and other strategies, more and more, you see. For example, you say, if you have phylacteries, put them in the middle of the night. So, first, what is astonishing, not in the middle of the night. If you have phylacteries, what does it mean you have phylacteries? He's writing for people who don't have phylacteries. So that's the most astonishing part. He's writing for Kabbalists who maybe don't have phylacteries. That is Now, in the middle of the night, not supposed to. No one ever wrote about phylacteries in the middle of the night. That is forbidden. So, his assumption is that phylactery is not a ritual. That enhancing a little bit, you know, it's like an ornament. So he's looking to it, and you know, if you have it, put it. An ornament that induces a certain state of mind, meaning it's not a ritual. That's why the phrase is, if you have it. Uh-huh. Excuse me?
Uh-huh.
That is the fascinating part. The middle of the night is for sure not a ritual. But he writes for people who maybe don't have phylacteries. So that is maybe Christians, maybe Kabbalists, not Kabbalists, young people who don't care about the Kabbalists. They are the public. Or saying, if a talit, you can put it. You don't have, don't put it. I mean, that's, you know, those. If you remember, the envelope of reminders, I mentioned, which was the ritual. He said, okay, you have put it, don't put it. You know, that's nice to have it in the middle of the night, you know, it's very romantic. And we have a painting, unfortunately, I don't have it here, in the Vatican. Maybe I put it here. In the Vatican Library, there is a painting together with the text of Apulafia. Someone with a phylactery in the middle of the night. It's not only written. Let's see, I don't know if I sent it to them or not. No. Meaning, which is, that is the astonishing part. Performative, not non-ritualistic. Very, very precise, but not related to issues related to ritual. What is precise is combinations of the letters of the divine name, which must be done in a very precise manner.
Mm-hmm.
So here we have a vision which is, in principle at least, open not only to the Jews. In fact, he comes with a new definition of Judaism. In my opinion, that was the core of his discussion with the Pope when it took place. Did it take place on the basis, that's not my guess, on the basis of what he wrote? He would tell the Pope that the Jew is someone who confesses the divine name. That's Judaism. That's a matter of mother, father, ritual, all those issues are for him at least less important. His definition of Judaism, which he's giving me a very fascinating. In Hebrew, the Jew comes from Yehuda. Yehuda is, the consonants are the divine name, plus the letter Dalet, which is related to confessing. Who is a Jew? Someone confessing the divine name. This is a brand new definition of Judaism, which is different from whatever we know in any source, before and after him. Including whatever reformed forms of Judaism you can imagine, no one would adopt such a religion, even today. As a matter of what fringe reform of Judaism will have, you don't have something so radical, saying that's a mental operation of confessing the importance of the divine name. So, this vision has a certain parallel. I don't say that it's influenced by Apulafia, but who knows? In the 16th century, not far away from here, there was a major figure named Bernardino da Siena. I don't believe that you heard about him, because you heard. Yes? Very nice. So, Bernardino da Siena, when I spoke with a Christian theologian about him, he said, you simply don't know. You cannot be that you know about it. That's why I did. Bernardino da Siena, in the 16th century, he created a movement of devotion to the name of Christ. He was going from city to city and preaching this religion based on the name of Christ. And he did it in Northern Italy, and then he moved to Aragon. And to very, my very great surprise, I was once in the cathedral in Barcelona. He is buried there, the place where Apulafia started his career. He finishes there. So that was amazing to see the dump of Bernardino Siena in Barcelona, where Apulafia started his career of Kabbalist, dedicated to the name of God. So here we have something which is radical. Nevertheless, Jews didn't burn his books. But on the contrary, like in the case of the controversy, copies were interested in him, they copied it. Didn't ask the rabbi, it is ostracized, not ostracized. They knew that ostracized. It was common knowledge. But people simply didn't care. Simply didn't care about this ban on Apulafia. And they copied, including, I know personally, very Orthodox Jew today in Safed, who copied all Apulafia's written handwriting, in his handwriting, to have a clean copy, nice copy. And he's exercising it. In Safed today, someone having 15 children at least, having a totally Orthodox life. He's not the only one, but meaning, despite the formal ban found in Halachic literature, even Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox Jews, that I know for sure from many, many sources, clandestinely are studying Apulafia, including today in the most ultra-Orthodox quarters in Jerusalem. No one admits it to, but I know for sure, because I give them manuscripts, coming back and telling me, you know, what they do, roughly, you know. So that's sure that, in a way, here we have another Kabbalah, totally different. Very suspect for major Kabbalists. Nevertheless, very important Kabbalists. Studied, commented, copied, used it, up to today. 10 years ago, I wouldn't dare to say what I'm daring now. Same now. No one printed Apulafia's books in 16, 17, 18, 19th century. No one. No one did. You know, Christians publish here and there some small quotes without knowing that Apulafia. When I spoke in the late 70s with Orthodox Kabbalists about printing these books, Kabbalists who print Kabbalistic books, so printing cards, they simply didn't want to pronounce the name, not to print the book. I mean, they were looking to me, how do I dare to pronounce the name today? In, if you know what is Mea Shearim, it's the most Orthodox part of the world. A set of Apulafia's books in print are sold together with the Bible, with the Talmud, Lurianic set, and then Apulafia. And that is sold in, I don't say all the bookshop, but I would say many, many of the bookshops. So if you don't see it, that's because someone bought it, you know. But otherwise, it's supposed to be there today in Mea Shearim. I don't speak about other places, which is obvious, but I speak about Orthodoxy. Strong Orthodox. So, in a way, something happened which is not so simple to explain, despite the fact I know many details, but all of them don't create a clear picture. What happened? That even the most cautious guys who wouldn't dare to mention the name are ready to print with the imprimatur. It's not clandestine printing. They don't know exactly who did it, with the imprimatur of rabbis, claiming now that Apulafia is one of the greatest ever, that written from preach, which is, I must say, hard for me to understand what happened to those guys, and what in Apulafia kept them so strong that they are ready to sign their name. I mean, rabbis in Mea Shearim, it's speak about what amazing rabbis, you know. Think about the rabbis in action, halachic figures. Well, I would say 10 years ago, wouldn't dare say the name, are now recommending the book as one of the biggest introductions, that each introduction to each book in the series is a piece in itself. Each introduction is, you read and don't believe it was written. Meaning someone, we are like animals waiting for the drop of your wisdom. There's some expressions which even Moses will describe in such a way. And that is keeping to appear new introductions from each of the volumes, again and again, with those exaggerations which are generated by any standard, you know. And I try to speak with them, what happened to you, and if you can explain me, you know, what happened. So they have their explanations, which I believe that they believe in it, but that doesn't convince me. But I don't understand so much what happened. But it happened. It happened already. Meaning that is a fact that's already 6-7 years that all his books almost are in print and have the box with a certain volume.
After 2000, maybe? Because every 10 years,
2000. The 2000 had no meaning in Jewish calendar. Meaning the Jewish calendar has another date. Yes, yes, so yes. It's those guys are not Messianic at all. 2000, they don't know. It's 2000, they have the Hebrew calendar. They started in 1999. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that I know that, but it's nothing to do with it. That's another explanation.
But
I wouldn't mind.
Excuse me.
To explain such a way, but that's not the way.
Philologically, what are the editions like? I mean, did they ask you to work on the editions?
Look, the editions are very bad.
Why?
But that's another story.
No.
That's it. It has nothing to do. You know, they are poor. They don't have.
I mean,
a philological education.
Since you are there and they are there, it would make sense, you know, to collaborate.
I collaborate. I'm telling them there are bad editions. And then they, you know, you don't believe. They print immediately another edition. They take another manuscript and print another edition and show me, no, look, it's a better edition. And it's a bad. So they had a third edition.
But it's differently bad.
No, not always bad. Meaning, they are so eager, they don't check the manuscript. So they can print a manuscript which misses a third of the book. And then I'm telling them, look, that's not a book. No. So they say, okay, no problem. We'll publish now a better one. But they don't have the time
to
collate manuscripts.
But they have no idea what manuscripts are.
They don't know. Okay. Kabbalists don't deal with manuscripts. Wow. They didn't print this book. Zakulafa for them is a challenge.
Yeah.
Someone never printed it. They don't know how to do it. I attempted to teach them.
Yeah,
exactly. And I succeeded in one case, but I'm not going to spend my life teaching the Kabbalists how to collate manuscripts. You know, that's their business. But no, they are ready to correct. There's no problem. But none of them is a critical edition, none of them. But what is fascinating, they are so eager to, okay, so we should have another edition. Simply no problem. And I have a certain book of Atulafia, one book, and three different editions year after year, not because it was sold. Because I understood that it's not a good edition. Now, another story, which I didn't investigate too much, that you wouldn't believe it's an Italian story. There's somewhere in Italy here, a center for translating Atulafia into English. And there are guys here translating the Bulafia from those editions, the bad editions, into English, and selling them in America. The set is almost finished. When I was in America, they sent me one of the last, which is another phenomenon. I don't know who they are. And I don't know why in Italy they must translate in English. Sell it in America, that's an issue. I don't have the nerve to start now to ask who are you and why, and but it is a phenomenon which is becoming now in the last 10, 12, 13 years much more widespread than I could imagine ever, including a community of Abu Lafians, all of them Christians, living as a community in Rio de Janeiro, which when they told me, I said, that's, you know, that's simply a misunderstanding. I don't understand what they are speaking about. And I refused to understand until I've seen it. Which, you know, even then I was sure I'm dreaming. But there are so solid facts that it's impossible for me to say that I dreamed. I mean, that is true. What I've seen, I have also other people who have seen it, and that's on the internet, and that's... meaning, that's a phenomenon which started, to some extent, with Umberto Eco. His fascination with Apulafia, but that's a phenomenon much wider than we can imagine. Not only literary, but also mystical, and bringing together the ultra-Orthodox with Brazilian Christians living together and pronouncing the divine name, and Vila with all the divine names on the ceilings, and that I've seen, and I looked more than once to be sure that's not a dream. And for sure not a dream. They have their ideas about Abu Lafia, which is not always Abu Lafia, but that's another stuff. For them, Abu Lafia is the founder. So something happened which hard for me to, I don't have a perspective. Maybe 10, 12 years we'll see what might be better. But that's not a fringe issue. It was never a fringe, I must say. Despite the fact that normal Kabbalists would say, no, that's nothing, that's not Kabbalah, that you hear from many Kabbalists. But de facto, on the terrain, situation is quite different from the point of view of manuscripts. Numbers of manuscripts, now editions, now you see the Mea Shearim together with all the classics, not just selling it, that's a set. Together with the most important canonical part of Judaism. There are databases for them. You have the Bible databases, then you have Abu Lafia, writings of Abu Lafia, databases together with all the classics. Sold again in Mea Shearim. That normal Jew should have this set today in his library, electronically or not electronically, that's another story. I would like now to move a little bit to Abu Lafia, the history of Abu Lafia in Italy, not in the Vatican, which is another story. Maybe the Pope will read this article and, you know, try to read the books of Abu Lafia in English, yes.
From where was Abu Lafia?
He was from Saragossa.
Spanish. So Spanish.
He was Spanish, yes. Mm-hmm. He was Saragossa, and apparently he knew Basco, which is...
He was a Jew. Did
he read my mother this Hebrew or in Arabic?
No, he read it in Hebrew. Apparently he didn't know Arabic, or he knew maybe rudimentary, maybe, no more. But he knew Basco, and I... all the time believe that I shall write an article about Bascon words in Abu Lafia, which are the earliest Basconian words. For sure it was Jewish from a relatively known family. It's an Arabic name.
This is why
Arabic name in Tel Aviv, if you say Abu Lafia, everyone knows about Abu Lafia, but not my Abu Lafia. In the Arabic Abu Lafia, sending Peters. It's, everyone knows Abu Lafia, but not this Abu Lafia.
And he wrote in Latin?
No, he wrote only in Hebrew. About Latin, I shall speak in a moment. He wrote only in Hebrew. Now, let me turn to Abu Lafia in Italian culture. Around 1480, the Kabbalists came in from Sicily, who converted to Christianity. Named Flavius Moncada Mithridates, among many other names, I don't remember all his names, and that's it. He came from Sicily, and he knew very well Abu Lafia, which is not simple. And he had a brilliant idea to translate Kabbalah into Latin, and to sell it to Piccolo Amenadro. Piccolo Mirandola was ready to spend a lot of his money on it, a lot that we know. And this guy translated several tens of books of Kabbalah. Many of them are worth. We have almost all the translations were in Vatican. So Abu Rafi arrived to Vatican after all. Today we have in Vatican a collection of the Latin translations of Abu Rafi. Still not printed in manuscript, but they are there. And Piccolo Mirandola complained that it cost too much, etc. But he bought all the translations. And that is the beginning of Christian Kabbalah, which is based on basically two pillars. One pillar is Kabbalah. From the point of view, statistically speaking, how many pages of Kabbalah are there from the entire Kabbalistic literature? He is for sure close to half. All the other Kabbalists, half Abu Rafi alone. Pico was fascinated by this part of Kabbalah, Abu Rafi. And in, at least in the thesis he wrote in 1486, having a long part of Kabbalah, you can see Abu Rafi, not by name, but the sources are verbatim. It's copying simply from the foundation. And he starts from time to time to make a comparison which is fascinating. Pico is saying, oh, this form of revolutia alphabetarum, meaning the combinations of letters, is very similar to Ramon Llull. That's an insight which I took it a little bit seriously, and to my, how to put it, astonishment, I'm sure that Ramon Llull was influenced by Abu Rafi also. And for reasons, I published articles and so on. I don't want to enter details. Meaning, Abu Rafi entered first the most important Catalan also ever. And I believe I have shown graphically, not ideas, simply the tables and the concentric circles of Llull. The great experts of Llull didn't know what to do with it, and they came to me to ask. I said, oh, no, there's no problem. I shall show you immediately table and circle. So they pushed me to give a lecture on Llull that I never thought they're going to do something like that. And they didn't have any other better answer, so I published many years ago such an article. No one questioned it for the time being. In fact, Llull was in contact with one of the students of Abu Rafi in Barcelona, that we had the incipit of the that's sure there was the contact. So exactly how much and how and when, that's a little bit more complicated. In any case, Abu Rafi was young. Older Llull was younger, he after Abu Rafi. So that's not a historical problem, that is the same city, Barcelona. But with Pico, the history is much more important because here we have the beginning of a certain development, a branch, if you like, of Christian theology. It's called Christian Kabbalah, which at least to a very great extent, meaning at least 50%, is stemming from Abu Rafi's translations in Latin. But that's not the whole story. In fact, there were also other servants in the time life of Pico who translated other texts of Abu Rafi in some form of dialect, which is Latin-Italian. Not Latin, not Italian.
What do you call it?
In a dialect, yes, which is not exactly Latin and not exactly Italian. And that was this article, I wrote an article to identify this circle, and this lady quoted this article. Your article, you know, Egidio del Tempo, and that is a circle which is a little bit before Egidio del Tempo. And they translated actually the Liber Circularum that you're quoting, but that is Abu Rafi's most important book, the book of the circles, was translated not only in Latin, but also in some form of Italian, in a circle related to Pico, but not exactly Pico Ficino. It's a smaller circle. That whole book written by a scholar from Bologna, Franco Bacchè, wrote the whole book identifying exactly this circle. I don't speak now about what happened later in history of Christian Kabbalah, when Abraham became even better known, again, in a very famous and influential book named De Harmonia Mundi, written in Venice. Abulafia is better represented than earlier. So we have a certain moment in which his spiritualistic assumptions entered late medieval, early Renaissance process, and contributed by this emphasis on language, is very, very important, on divine names. Another form of speculation is always Bernardin da Siena, I must say, didn't have enough time to check if it's Abulafia or Abulafia. It wouldn't be a surprise for me, because that's 16th century. Could read, because we read others. But that, I don't claim, it's only bizarre to say how two different people are creating religions based on contemplations of names. But in a way, we can see how this issue related to names, combinations of names, interpretation, radical interpretation, is entering Italian culture. And then you have, out of the blue, a book written in the 50s about open work by Eco. By then, I believe he didn't know Abulafia. I'm pretty sure he didn't know Abulafia. Nevertheless, the theory of this open work that came, which he a little bit moderated it later, and when he discovered Abulafia, he fell in love with Abulafia. This issue seems to me not accidental, because he could read it in Pico. He didn't need Abulafia. He could read Pico's thesis. So we have something that transpired beyond Kabbalah, something in culture, which is more diffuse than to say someone is a Christian Kabbalist. That is very technical and very linked. But this idea of radical hermeneutics, that you can take a text and you combine and change the, you know, the old of the letters and interpret the new words and instead of the old words, and you believe that is real interpretation, the highest interpretation, that reached also Derrida verbatim. That's not a question, yes or no. 1000% Derrida is copying from Abulafia, without saying Abulafia, saying it's written in Kabbalah. And then he's quoting verbatim Abulafia, together with Mallarmé. If he had the influence of Mallarmé or not, that's another story, but at least Derrida had an insight, you know, wow, that is like Kabbalah. And then he quotes Abulafia. So there is a certain form of transformation which is going beyond the technicalities of Kabbalah. And there is a certain form or another, I would say, European tradition, which, again, I don't have the time to enter, but if we have a look to what happened the last 50 years in the European, how to put it, worldview, what's called the linguistic term, you'll see that they were not the first. It was Arnold Lul, and it was Pico, and it was Egino da Viterbo, it was Francesco Giorgio Veneto. People claiming that language, and this is the most important issue, the manipulation of language is a very high form of how to put it, mental preoccupation. If you like to see mental preoccupation, if you like to see, you know, the end of this for the time being, development, read Eco's Pendulum of Foucault, Foucault's Pendulum. There we'll see not only the name of Abulafia, but you'll see the technique openly, part maybe the core of the number. So here we can see actually Kabbalah, which being not ritualistic, but being linguistic, was much more open to be appropriated in non-Jewish circles, and had a history which I try to present very moderately, because there are also other agents, and more and more fascinating, but a little bit more tentative. What I said now, I believe I can show 100%. I don't have to convince you that Umberto Eco is speaking about Amunah, it's written there in the first pages. Most of the quotes in the mottos are from Abu Rafi, and the technique is from Abu Rafi, and there are issues which are evident. Now, that is an avatar which is very, very strong. Meaning that it's not a matter of he is right or not. That's a symptom of something which is going beyond the translations of Abu Rafi and Ita. It's not because of that, it's because of reasons I don't know. Not related to him, doesn't know about it. So, we have actually with this form of Kabbalah another structure which was not easily accepted by other Kabbalists and still not accepted, but nevertheless survived and created another structure which influenced, I must say, a long series from Lul to Leibniz. His theories of metathesis, universalis, has combined, in order to have all the languages, and Walter Benjamin, and in the long series of issues, which I cannot enter in all the details, which is another tradition alternative to the Greek philosophy. That I would like to emphasize. Meaning, when Derrida is telling us there is logocentrism, the whole story is actually very similar to Abu Rafi, who was influenced by Maimonides, but he believed there's something higher, and that is the linguistic. And such a minor European tradition, because it's Lul, and it's Pico, and it's Leibniz, and today, the guys I mentioned today, that's for sure a European tradition. Owes a lot to this fascination with language more than with the Greek. So I was told that it's dead then.
Yes.
Okay. It's something. Verona. So if you believe in Verona, you wrote Abu Rafi influence, you were wrong. So the most important figure in Verona is Romeo and Julia. Who is? So, what I'm saying now, I don't know if it's my opinion or not, as if you don't know. But at least according to Umberto Eco, Dante was influenced by Abu Rafi. And he made an effort to demonstrate it in his book, La ricerca della lingua perfetta. Pages. The truth is, I don't know. Maybe yes, maybe no. But we shouldn't forget Dante, at least in Verona. So maybe also Dante should be added to a list, modest one, but nevertheless, it's important to know at least the hypothesis that Abu Rafi had an influence on the theory of language of Dante. And there are debates about this issue. I know there are different scholars, but Eco is also a scholar. Okay, so this was my late addition to the list I mentioned earlier, that Pico was not the first. Okay, now if we have questions, well, now is the time for
questions.
Final questions, yes.
It's one question. Could you draw a parallel between this interest for language and, for example, the linguistics of Chomsky, Noam Chomsky, Sapir, Jacobson?
I cannot do you know, this time in all of them. But if you take Noam Chomsky, Noam Chomsky is a guy who knows Hebrew. Not being Israeli, but his father was a great Hebraist, someone who in America decided to speak Hebrew. That's a big, how to put it, big decision. You know, there are not too many Jews in America that by choice prefer to speak Hebrew in their house. So Noam Chomsky for sure knows something about it. I don't believe that he knows about Kabbalah. I don't want to spend now, you know, what I said, the list is, you know, long enough. I don't need now Noam Chomsky, but it, there are issues which are interesting. Abu Lafia would say that language is an innate characteristic. Man is language. And even in an article which I wrote about, there's an experiment, hopefully not done, but at least mentioned in Italy several times, that Frederick II wanted to know what the origin of language. So he made an experiment with infants. People didn't speak the infant. And they checked what language is he speaking. What language did he speak? Hebrew. So if you ask me if it's true or not, I don't know. Abu Lafia speaks about this experiment. This experiment is mentioned actually two or three times in a certain century. Abu Lafia is one of them. What is bizarre is Abu Lafia is laughing. They made such an experiment, that's impossible. The infant is not going to speak any language. Not Hebrew, not any language. But he was interested in the question. Like Chomsky, he didn't believe it's going to be Hebrew. But he believed that we have the capacity for language. So from this point of view, he's very close to Chomsky. And in an article I wrote about this experiment, and you can read it in Italian, basically, this article was published as an appendix to my book, Kabbalah in Italian. And there, Fabrizio Levi, who we've seen here, translated as an appendix my discussion of this experiment, and I believe that I'm mentioning Chomsky and his student Pinsker. A short comment about decision. The other two, Safar, was also Jewish and also Jacobson. I believe that in their cases I cannot find something substantial. But, you know, that doesn't mean that there is nothing, but, you know, I am not an expert in everything. Yes, yes.
Concerning, you spoke of Ovadiah, the Sufi experience, mystical experience,
yeah,
the time.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, because it's also a mystical experience.
Yeah. So, to explain, Maimonides created philosophy, created Kabbalah by Antiochus, created Abu Lafia by direct influence, but he created something more. Also Jewish Sufism. Not by himself, but by the fact that he gave birth to a son named Abraham Maimonides, who had a son named Obadiah Maimonides, who were mystics, not philosophers, mystics, Sufi mystics. That happens because Maimonides didn't have time to educate his son, otherwise he wouldn't become a Sufi. So, we have in the lifetime of Abu Lafia a different line of Jewish mysticism found in Egypt and afterwards in Syria until it disappeared in mid 15th century, of descendants of Maimonides who were mystics, but their mysticism has nothing to do with Kabbalah, but has to do basically with Sufis. Now, I cannot enter here students of Abulafia, not Abulafia himself, maybe were influenced by Sufis. But not by those Jewish Sufis, but by Sufis in itself. Because Sufis, you know, his students were in Sicily. Sicily was replete with Arabic culture, Byzantine culture, Arabic culture, Spanish culture, whatever you want, Jewish culture too. I mean, there was a lot of cultures there. The fact that his school develops there makes it plausible that he was acquainted with North African Sufis. A student of Abulafia was influenced, in my opinion, by Sufis, but not the Jewish Sufis, but the Sufis of the school of Ibn Arabi in Damascus. Ibn Arabi, who died in the year that Abulafia was born, 1240, he is buried in Damascus. And there was a school of Sufis following his direction, which came in contact with a certain student of Abulafia who was living in Safed around 1290. Once I wrote an article about this meeting. A meeting, you know, in principle, ideas. You don't know Sufis, so I'll tell you about what is there. If not, it's a waste of time. I thought, look, we have here a student of Abulafia coming from Sicily to Galilee. Galilee is not far away from Damascus. In Damascus, we have the students of the Arabi alive. And we have something very, very close. So I wrote, it's very plausible that they met. 10 years later, in Safed, someone found a cave with an inscription of the students of the Arabi, exactly in the place where this student of Abulafia was born, which was the only prophecy I had in my life. I couldn't believe the guy who discovered, never heard about it, my hypothesis, that could use me. They discovered, archaeological discovery, they published it, and without knowing what I wrote. And someone drew to my attention, oh, look what happened. You know, they found an inscription in Safed, in this period dated, the same decade I claimed that it was a meeting. And, okay, so that's a student of Abulafia. I know the name, and actually, you can read it in Italian. I translated, but I wrote a huge book on this student, named Nathan Ben Sadia Harar. He was from Messina. He wrote the book in Messina, and then he left for Galilee. And in my opinion, Galilee, he met real Sufi, not Jewish Sufi. Sufi. And that's what I claimed in this book printed by Adelphi some 4 or 5 years ago. No, 8 years ago. So that you can find it there, because then I knew already about the cave, about everything, which I didn't know when I wrote it in, you know, in the 70s. So there was but for Abulafia himself, I believe the Sufis transmitted only the Hindu part of the yoga. Because he was not in India, and I don't believe he met yoga masters. However, in 12th century, a certain Arabic, very important encyclopedist named Al-Biruni translated Patanjali yoga into Arabic. And my assumption is that Arabic translation via Sufis arrived at Abulafia. So I don't say that he didn't know anything about Sufis, that's for sure not. But the real encounter takes place generation after him. Well, we can find very, very strong, specifically Sufi terminology not found elsewhere in general. So that's why I believe Damascus was the clue of the encounter between Abulafia's Kabbalah. Now, that is true that Obadiah and Abraham, his father, later David, all of them descendants of Maimonides. You can see what happens. The great philosopher produced only mystics. They were close to the idea of prophecy. But that's done in a different way. I mean, that's not a combination of divine names, inspiration. Yes.
Yeah. I have a question about Telegram. When you started, you said that the Torah was a book written for society, the book of Torah. Okay, you said something that is containing the way of the people yes. have to live.
Yes. I believe that is simple.
There it is. Second, you said that Tefillin are to remember that God exists. I just want to, if I really understood. The last question, sorry, it's more difficult. When I have three or four Kabbalah tomes, but the first one I always remember, I open, it was written regarding God with a lady, the God was the lady, and then, you know, something like this, the approach of God. I heard the problem also that there was something between man and woman.
What's the question?
Eh?
What is the question?
The question is, would you explain to me a little bit more what is this?
Yes, you can write books about it.
okay. Is it enough?
Let's put it very, you know, very simple.
Yeah, this is what I want.
Now it's too late.
No.
Let's put it very simple.
Yes.
If we ask, what is the one most important commandment in today's, what would be your answer?
Love, to love God.
Other answers? What would be the most important?
To respect the other, to love each other.
More, into today's. I'm not going to say what the first commandment.
The first commandment.
Yes.
What?
There is just one God.
No.
So?
To keep Shabbat.
No, there
isn't one more important.
Justice.
No. The one most first commandment in the Bible.
In the Bible.
And also conceived to be the most important by the rabbis later. Yeah. Is to procreate. It's not to study Torah, monotheism, all this stuff. All this stuff. That's ideology. What is written in the Bible? The first thing is about man before Shabbat. It's written in verse 27. You should procreate and govern or master the world. That is the first commandment. And that was conceived to be, not because it was in the first chapter of the Bible, but because the rabbis conceived this commandment to be the most important one. That remained the most important one. Which means, you know, to procreate, you must have some relationship with a woman. That's why in Judaism you don't have monasticism or ascetics. That's why Kabbalah, when speaking about what I spoke about, men, male, female, that's not an exception. You believe that maybe, you know, those guys were erotically, you know, crazy, not at all. That has to do with an explanation of the most important commandments. So, in the verse 26, it's written, in the image of God, male and female. And next to it is written, procreate. So that is, obviously, for someone reading the Bible, the first and most important divine. Now, in order to understand something like that, how to do, you must give some space for the woman. And that's impossible otherwise. I don't say now that Judaism is better or worse from the point of view related to the woman. That's another story. I believe it's better, but that's a matter of a long book. But without entering into this issue.
Thank you.
No, you can read the part of it. I wrote it. It's not the first time I'm saying it. I wrote it in a book translated by Elizabeth as a printed in Adept. I wrote it, but very short, relatively short, to what I shall hopefully do. Including very clear discussions of equality in thinking of the quality. There's no way I am telling you that the quality is written there 100%. But that's another story. What I would like to tell you is the fact that the vision of the Kabbalist speaking about male and female powers is not a distortion or an innovation or some idiosyncratic ideas. It is an attempt to fill out, to flesh out what is the meaning of such a government. So how can you write about something like that without dealing of male and female in eroticism? It's simply impossible. If you assume that I'm right, I'm 1000% right. You can open the Bible. So what they attempt to do, not some, I don't know, perversion, theological perversion. So you remember what I told you. In the time of the Bible, there were inscriptions about God and his wife named Asherah. When the Bible didn't like it, that's another story. But it was around. And the idea of procreation is very, very, very important. And, in fact, what is the meaning? You remember I quoted the psalm about the king. You are my son. Today I gave birth to you. What meaning is such an idea? For sure, the Bible is elliptic and you don't have too many details, but try to think about it. I claim that God has a son. How is someone having a son?
He has a wife.
Excuse me?
So if he has a son, he has a wife.
And they probably have sex
together. So I'm speaking about issues which we can open the Bible now. We have another interpretation, I'm glad to learn. So what the Kabbalists have done is to attempt to flesh out, to think what's going on. You know, how can we understand something like that? What is the meaning of something so important? That's a detail. So they arrive to a theology which gives meaning to this commandment. I hope I answered it.
Yeah, right. Thank you very
this
much.
This issue, I shall answer you in a long book dealing with this issue, which is apparently unknown even to the Jews. And I'm asking, what the first commandment? No one knows what the first commandment. People are telling me that I'm one God. So that's written, they would tell me, that's written long, long after the first chapter of Genesis. First chapter of Genesis is also part of the Bible. You cannot ignore it, say, no, the commandments are, no, I don't know, the Ten Commandments are more or less important. Jews don't really too much the Ten Commandments. For reasons I cannot enter here. Those that they don't know, but it's not the same importance that we assume. We assume that they are more important because they are on the tables of Moses and ta-da-da. We have a vision that's practically in the Siddur, for example.
Yes.
Which is the most important Jewish book. We don't have the Ten Commandments. Yeah. You have them?
So,
no. What's going on? That's the book repeated by the Jews all the time. If that's the most important issue, you have whatever topic to discuss it. This issue is to my best knowledge in the normal Siddurim is on fire. So I would like not to enter. That's I can write a book, I hope.
Are you writing the book?
I hope. I'm writing, you know, what I'm going to finish and what I'm going to do, you know, because tomorrow is a bite of people. Yes.
Kabbalistic perspective, you pointed out several avenues for the development of future education. One was the elucidation of the thought processes of the Kabbalists.
Yeah.
Another one was the study of living Kabbalists.
Yeah.
Has any work been undertaken in either of these directions?
Sure. Now it's not an industry, but that's a line. Some students of mine are interested in what's going on today. And there is a book, at least one book already in English. The other one is going to be completed at the end. Jonathan Garb.
As in G-A?
Garb, like government. Jonathan Garb. I forgot exactly what the quotation Hertz, but look, Jonathan Garb, one book published by Yale University Press a year and a half ago. So that is dealing with Kabbalah in the 20th century. Another Sundermar wrote several articles, which are going to become a book, again, about Kabbalah in the 20th century. And I hope sometime when I shall have perspective to write a book about my encounters with the Kabbalists, not you know, what you read in books, but what you heard unofficially. And all the stories about Apollonia sprinting and exercises and all this stuff, which that's testimonies which are not known and not found in reading.
What about the thought processes of the Kabbalists? Have these been researched?
We started a little bit with these articles of Shahrazi, and it's also another topic which should be developed, but to tell you that I should write a book, I wrote. The problem is
yes,
it's published.
I know. I would like to read it.
I too, yes. But it's a book. Meaning, yes, that's an issue, very difficult. I must say my part of it is very modest. Because I have there other people who know more about these issues. The problem is they don't know the text. I know the text, they know the theory. So, in a way, we cooperate. We see. Meaning, yes, that's an issue which several articles were published, including one that David has, maybe you know, about Shannon, so you know this article on consciousness. And there are more. One in Hebrew and one more in English. And I hope to write alone, first time alone, an article on this issue about some form of hypnosis in Kabbalah. But that's, who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, and I hope. I mean, that's not the general hope. Yeah. I have here part of it. I have in my iPod part of it. That I must learn a lot for writing something like that, to learn a lot, which is not simple, to learn about all those cognitive sciences and neurology and hypnosis, and, you know, it's difficult for me. But I make efforts, nevertheless. Okay, other questions? About the past, not only about the future, yes. I know more about the past.
I have another question about the past.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Yes.
Is there any evidence anywhere for use of psychoactive substances by Kabbalists?
That's, you know, that's an issue that you can imagine. That in America today, everyone would like to find something like that. For the simple reason to vindicate the use of drugs by the scholars themselves. So what is sure, I can tell you for sure, scholars are doing it, scholars of Kabbalah. Mm-hmm. Not Kabbalists, they don't know. Scholars of Kabbalah, two of them in America, without divulging names, were using it. They also attempted to tempt it. So I tried also, didn't work. So if I am, an example, it doesn't work at all. I don't know how, it doesn't work. Kabbalism itself apparently did not, with an exception of an obscure part of the Book of the Zohar, which is interpreted by Daniel Matt as dealing with, I have a student in Australia who claims that it was very, very important. She gave a lecture not far away from here in Prado, some 8 months ago, claiming this issue. My student is very nice, but I am not convinced. Nevertheless, what seems to me much more substantial, and I believe also important, is that the founder of Hasidus did it. Meaning, he used the pipe a lot. And people are relating his experiences to consuming this pipe, which cannot be, that's very clear, that is not a hint. So you can say, pipe, we're also using the pipe, it doesn't mean the drugs. But it's not so simple, because they are speaking about having experiences. And in one very interesting case, the founder of Hasidus, the pipe was not our pipe, the known pipe, that's a Turkish pipe. What do you call it? Some Russians came, soldiers, and took from him the pipe. So he told his friend, "Should wait a little bit. And some minutes will go after them, they are going to sleep." So he knew that in this pipe there is something that is going to put the Russian to sleep. Okay, so that seems to me to be a nice indication. It's not written, you know, exactly what the formula was there. But I don't know if you would call it drugs.
They have a prophetic dreams.
No. Excuse me? No, this part is very related in Hasidus. People say this part is very, very important. So, I don't know if so, have drugs so strong like the Ben Shannon use, for example. But apparently, there was something there. That means they were aware of what happened. You know, it gives them a good feeling, so they consume more and more and more, and that's all, you know. You would ask, you know, him, did he use drugs? So, I didn't.
No, of course, you know, they didn't have the idea of drugs, and yeah, they didn't work for drugs.
Yeah, so that's, you know, that is the only real substantial, and that's not our interpretation. That's too strong to speak about interpretation. And we're speaking about the founder of Hasidus, not just minor figure. So otherwise, I don't know about discussions. That doesn't mean they didn't consume drugs all the time. It seems they didn't write about it. So I know what they wrote. So on this heavy note, we're on the drugs, we're finishing our.
We hope to see you again here soon.
No, not too soon. Too soon will mean that I lost here something very important. I must return.
Thank you. That's very good.
You spoke about performative community.
Yes.
Did Sholem speak about this issue in his work?
No. Very simply, for one simple reason. Because he didn't see in Berlin a performative community. The Jews in Berlin were intellectual Jews, interested in many, many things, but not in rituals. Someone who read Sholem carefully will find two different, in the very introduction of his book from Berlin to Jerusalem, what was the Berlinese attitude of the Jews to rituals? One was, you know, with the Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, when people fast. So there was a certain restaurant in Berlin where people were consuming food in Yom Kippur. But it was not nice to see them. So it was a room for the people who fast. The people who fast eat there. So that is the attitude of the performative community. Sholem is mentioning by himself. It's not mine. So that's a strong example. Mm-hmm. So that you fast, but you know, you fast on the street, you know. Then you go to a restaurant, you would like not to be seen. So you eat with all the other people who fast in a small, you know,
room.
So that is the performative community Sholem has seen. Even closer to him is his father. who, after lighting the candles in the eve of Shabbat, the father was taking the cigarette and saying, we finished our job in the world. Who is spread one of these? So we don't need more. So those are two examples found in the first 10 pages of Sholem's description of Jewish burial. His family, not a very strong performative community. So that is the reason why he was not so concerned about it, because he believed Kabbalah is theology. We need also some form of theology to understand what happened. You know, that Hegel and Kant don't have anything. So let's speak about Tikkun, about Tzimtzum, just great ideas as if the Kabbalists were all the time thinking that God is collapsing. So he put a strong emphasis on elements which were cerebral, because that was Berlin in his lifetime. The missions, great ideas, big mission in the world, monotheism. You remember my first remarks? The father of Sholem. Had he seen another form of humanity, he wouldn't say something like that. He'd say, look, there are ideas and there are X and Y and something more variegated. He has seen something differently. Something different. He didn't like it. It's true. But on the other side, he didn't have an alternative. So in the moment he was seeing another type of Jew, he was very attracted by it. Like Rubashov, coming from Eastern Europe, they are the real Jews. But Rubashov himself was not such a real Jew. He was interested in Sabbatism. So the real Jew for Sholem was someone interested in Sabbatism. So if you look in such a way, you can see why ritual is much less important. Would you ask Sholem, ritual is important for Kabbalah? He would say, yes. But de facto, the answer in his writings is no. Despite the fact he would for sure recognize it. So there is not a joke and not an anecdote that people claim Sholem had an incredible library. People claim, and I don't say it's true or not, that his library, the most important book about the ritual, Shulchan Aruch, was not found. If that's true, that is the answer of Sholem to your question. The most important book on Jewish ritual, in an incredible library on tools, maybe one of the best in the world, you don't find the most important book for the rituals. I don't say it's true. There are rumors. It's a problem to judge. If you go to the Sholem library, it's found there. But the problem is who bought it and when Sholem bought it, or someone else bought it and put it in the library. It's not so simple to establish when this book entered the library. But people who lived there, in his apartment, like I've known, that was their impression. So that's they were very, very wise people. People understood what they were seeing. So the answer is a bit more complex. I mean, you must see in order to believe. He has seen what he has seen, his father smoking, you know, claiming that we finished our mission. Passé. Or people, you know, in Yom Kippur, eating in Yom Kippur. You know, we were a little bit ashamed, but that's okay. So, this is the community he has seen. And the other community he has seen were anarchists. Or Sabbateans, or people understand than Sabbateans. And he was fascinated by it. So that's not exactly ritualistic comments. And he was, as he put it very openly, the only religious philosophy I believe in it is anarchism. That's a statement of Sholem. That's a ritual comment. Oh, I can give you many, many examples why he would for sure recognize what I said here. He wouldn't have a problem. But that was post factum. When you ask him, I said, ah, yes, for sure. But what he wrote, you can see what he wrote. What are the titles of his books? What are the titles of his chapters? So he has an article about rituals. So I would like not to enter now in details. I wrote an article about this article. What is ritual? Rabbinism is an hypertrophy. Hypertrophy of ritual. There are too many. What do you mean hypertrophy of ritual? There are too many. If you say the hypertrophy, it means, you know, better than much less. So that is in the article about the ritual. So what do you expect more? I am finished. I don't know.
Do you have questions? Last question? Okay.
Chiedo solo, scusate un secondo, perché la presidente della fondazione.
Vi rubo due minuti e basta, ma volevo. Sono tutti presi da.
Sì.
Volevo solo alla conclusione di questi giorni intensi di lavoro ringraziare moltissimo il professor Idel per la sua presenza qui e per il suo straordinario intenso lavoro di studioso. Grazie professore, grazie di aver accettato di venire da noi. Spero che potremo ancora collaborare, insomma, e speriamo di averla ancora qui. Ringrazio anche a voi di aver partecipato e spero che vi siate trovati a vostro agio nella fondazione e spero di potervi rivedere nelle prossime attività della nostra fondazione. Grazie a tutti.
Scusate, aggiungo io una cosa che può essere, mi diceva adesso Elisabetta Zeri della Lessi, che se qualcuno di voi volesse magari dei libri del professor Ida, lei può farli avere con uno sconto significativo,
però non individualmente, perché non è possibile,
no,
cioè, se tu puoi convogliare un gruppo di coordinazione e no, come studio centro studi Campostrini faccio tutta una spedizione.
Ma, benissimo, quindi voi vedete che voi dalla fondazione, se volete segnate la mia mail, così
questo è appena stampato,
è quella
della fondazione, il nome Davide,
Davide
punto assai che è Ancona, Savona Ancona, Empoli, Livorno,
noi abbiamo tre volumi
assai chiocciola Centro Studi chiocciola Centro Studi campostrini.it, così che io ricevo di ordine la fondazione centrale e così
io devo mandare un altro subito perché abbiamo le mail
sbroccate.
Grazie.
E poi scusate, ho trovato questo qui nel lavandino del bagno, non è di nessuno, un braccialetto
di
eccolo,
il mio cuore. Chiocciola del.